Gut Doctor Podcast, where Dr. Neil Parikh describes GI disorders and answers common questions related to the GI tract. Please note this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. We hope you enjoy.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back on GI 101. And today we welcome back Dr. Neil Curry, who's going to give us an overview of the recent updates in the guidelines and management of acute pancreatitis. Neil, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So before we get into the new guidelines for the management of acute pancreatitis, let's go over some basics because, you know, this is GI 101 after all. So why don't you define for our audience what is pancreatitis or acute pancreatitis?
Absolutely. So to define acute pancreatitis, you basically need two of three criteria. One would be the classic abdominal pain. So this is typically like a mid-epigastric pain radiating to the back. This is what we classically see in pancreatitis. Number two would be biochemical evidence. So that would be typically a lipase greater than three times the upper limit of normal. And the third would be CT evidence of pancreatitis or inflammation around the pancreas or in the pancreas. And again, you just need two of these three criteria to make a diagnosis. So that means you don't always need a CT scan off the bat to diagnose pancreatitis.
I think that's important to note because we often think of a radiographic evidence for acute pancreatitis, but it could be the symptoms and the lipase like you mentioned.
Yes.
So let's talk next causes. Now, typically, I know we think of, at least I feel like in America, when I was in training, we thought of gallstones and alcohol as I think the two most common, but of course there's many more. So why don't you kind of detail those for us?
Definitely. So when I was in med school, I learned a mnemonic or an acronym, I get smashed. I think many of people might have heard of that as well. So that kind of helps me in my mind, you know, remember all the different etiologies. So just to go through that briefly, idiopathic, gallstones, ethanol, trauma, steroids, mumps, autoimmune, scorpion bite, hypertriglyceridemia or hypercalcemia, ERCP, and drugs.
And interesting. I had not heard of that mnemonic, but I think I'm just that much older than you. but scorpion bite, I think that's probably a good board's question, so that's good to know.
Yeah.
Obviously, yeah. We talk about gallstones. We think of alcohol. Trauma, I think I've seen before. Unfortunately, more motor vehicle accidents. Mumps, we just don't see too much of. I know the hypertriglyceridemia and hypercalcemia, we always check those labs when we're not sure why somebody's got pancreatitis. I've seen that. And obviously post-procedure with an ERCP. Drugs, any common drugs you want to tell the audience that we should look out for?
So some common drugs. So, you know, I typically go on up to date if I have a patient with pancreatitis just to review, because, you know, it's sort of like hard to remember sometimes. Steroids, we mentioned. Marijuana is actually one that's a class 1A that people may not think about. There's certain like antihypertensives like hydrochlorothiazide, azathioprine. There's a bunch of medications. So I typically like to go to up to date and just like review the patient's med and cross-reference that list just to make sure we're not missing anything.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
When I was a resident, I remember there were those scoring systems out there when a patient came in, and some of these were ER-based, some of these were when they're already on the floor. Is that still something that you find valuable or the guidelines recommend?
Yeah, so I feel like there's so many scoring systems, and I just feel like that they don't have that much clinical value. At the end of the day, you kind of just look at the patient, you know, how sick are they? Are they meeting SIRS criteria? And what are their BUN and their hematocrit? And the recent ACG 2024 guidelines are focusing in on this as well. And I feel like a lot of us have been doing this, but, you know, looking at the BUN and the hematocrit, it kind of tells you how hemoconcentrated the patient may be, how food volume down they may be, and kind of watching their response to fluids and seeing if the BUN and hematocrit come down, that's an important thing to see. If they don't go down or if they actually are rising, that's kind of a red flag. So really rising BUN and hematocrit and SIRS criteria, those are more important to look for rather than going through any of those scoring systems.
Well, I mean, that makes it easier. I
Yeah.
remember the some of those were quite complicated and required like the admission value, the ER value, and then the change after a day or two. So no, you're right. I mean, SIRS is simple enough, and I do remember the hematocrit being key. You mentioned fluids, right? You mentioned you want to see these come down with the BUN hematocrit with fluids. Where are we now with the type of fluid? You know, we I think everyone agrees that IV fluids are important. Does it matter? All LR, normal saline, anything there?
I'd say it does matter. For the first time, the ACG guidelines are saying that they do prefer LR over NS. I went back to look. So the last guidelines were in 2013 for ACG, and they said that LR may be the preferred fluid. But now, although it is a weak recommendation, low quality of evidence, so this is basically expert opinion, they are saying they do prefer LR. And they did give a couple of reasons why they believe, there's some evidence that it may decrease systemic inflammation and that it's more pH balanced and that the calcium in the fluid may bind to certain fatty acids that are known to cause worsening disease. So they have some evidence behind it. And I would say based off that, it's good to use LR.
So how much LR do should we be giving? You know, how much fluids we used to always write, you know, aggressive IV hydration or IV fluid resuscitation as part of the recommendations. Is that still the case?
So it's definitely good to give a lot of IV fluids. We want to prevent pancreatic necrosis. But now we do have some data to suggest that moderate fluid resuscitation can lead to similar outcomes with less complications, such as volume overload, rather than just really early aggressive IV fluids. There was the Waterfall trial in 2022, which was a randomized prospective study. And the new 2024 ACG guidelines are quoting this study, and as a result, they're recommending moderately aggressive fluid resuscitation, which is 1.5 cc's per kilogram per hour. If the patient still looks like volume down on admission, they should still get bolus and that sort of thing. But in terms of for maintenance fluids, it should be more of a 1.5 cc's per kilogram per hour.
Another big management decision when it comes to acute pancreatitis beyond fluid resuscitation is pain management or pain control. And this has always been a challenge for a variety of reasons. Any updates here?
So in terms of the guidelines, they don't actually mention pain control. And I think it's because it's quite difficult, right? There's not a lot of data on this, and it's sort of, hard, especially us as consultants. Sometimes we may give some recommendations on pain control, but it's really the primary team who's ultimately going to be making the final call. I did see that there was a recent double-blinded RCT. Sample size was about 48 patients, published in CGH, and they compared buprenorphine and diclofenac for pain relief and pancreatitis. So that was pretty cool to see an RCT on this. I think we definitely need some more data, but buprenorphine was more effective than diclofenac with a similar safety profile. So again, I think at the end of the day, for now, just I would give some multimodal analgesia, and if we are giving opioids, maybe careful dosing. Maybe have a PRN bowel regimen. But sounds like NSAIDs alone probably won't be enough. These patients have some serious pain.
All right, so we talked fluids, we talked pain control. I think the two other big management things as a consultant for acute pancreatitis is feeding and antibiotics. So let's go with feeding first. Any updates there? When to advance diet, parenteral nutrition, etc.?
No major updates, still recommending early oral feeding, advancing to a low-fat diet, especially someone with mild, like mild pancreatitis. They're saying that you can really kind of just put them straight to an oral diet. Like you don't have to go to liquids first and that sort of thing. So enteral feeding is definitely better than, parenteral and that sort of thing.
And what about antibiotics? Any role prophylactically? Any updates there for acute pancreatitis?
So still no role for prophylactic antibiotics, but in terms of pancreatic necrosis, there was something new I saw in the guidelines. They're actually recommending against a CT-guided FNA for guiding antibiotics in patients with suspected infected pancreatic necrosis. They're basically saying if the suspicion is high for pancreatic necrosis, so if, patient has fever, rising white count, all these things, they recommend just empirically giving antibiotics with certain antibiotics that we know that they penetrate the pancreatic necrosis. So these are carbapenems, cephalosporins, fluoroquinolones, and metronidazole. So they felt that the FNA wasn't really changing management a whole lot, and there was concern for seeding as well. So they're kind of just scratching the whole FNA part of management.
Yeah, that's a big difference because that's a invasive procedure. So yeah, if we can avoid that and management and safety profile is good, then that's a great step forward.
Absolutely.
Speaking of safety and interventions and invasiveness, often we as gastroenterologists will see pancreatitis in the post-ERCP phase. And I know over the past many decades there have been a variety of measures we have taken to prevent this post-ERCP pancreatitis. Did the new guidelines talk about this? Any changes? Anything we need to do differently?
No major changes. They're still saying that rectal endomethacin, 100 milligrams per rectum, either before or after the procedure, it seems to definitely be beneficial. They did mention, though, that there's evidence between pancreatic duct stenting, and there was a recent well-designed multicenter NIH-sponsored study that showed patients who were at high risk for post-ERCP pancreatitis. They were less likely to have recurrence if they were given both rectal endomethacin and a PD stent. So that's something to think about for our advanced endoscopists.
Neil, as we sort of wrap up here, anything else new or interesting you'd think our listeners would want to know about the latest guidelines here?
Yeah, one final comment. I would say I felt it was interesting that they're starting to recommend. So they said that for patients with a second episode, just a second episode of acute pancreatitis without a clear cause. So, there's no clear, even if there's no clear gallstones, they don't have alcohol, any of triglycerides, any of that stuff. They said that you could consider going straight for a cholecystectomy, even if you don't see
Interesting.
gallstones. So I thought that was interesting. They based this off of some data. There was a meta-analysis in patients with pancreatitis of no clear etiology. They had extensive testing, including EUS and things like that. These patients got a cholecystectomy. The ones who got a cholecystectomy had fewer recurrences of pancreatitis, 11% versus 39% for those who did not. So that was pretty significant. They said, based off this data of a meta-analysis, you could consider going straight for a cholecystectomy just in the second time. So I'd be interested to see what our surgery colleagues feel about that.
Wow, that would be interesting. That'd be a true paradigm shift there.
Yes, absolutely.
Neil, thank you very much for this time today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.